the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Engelhart. And this is Radioactivity. Sean is on vacation this week, and so various programmers are filling in for him, and we're filling in today.
Well, we are going to extend with climate change. I hope you were just listening to the show, and you heard about the youth that are going to striking for climate change tomorrow, March 15th, the Ides of March. But they're not coming to kill Caesar. They're just trying to improve our world considerably. And so I'm really excited about this show. Our first guest is going to be John Cook, and we will be calling him in just a few moments. And then I was able to catch up with Dr. Brad Ho yesterday from the National Center for Science Education, and he is going to be bringing us up to date on some of the measures that are being taken against science educators and trying to influence the teaching of science. And for what it's worth, climate change is being put in the same category as teaching evolution. And we do know, and we've just gotten done with our governor where we were not allowed to mention climate change.
And we'll take a few of your calls after each of these guests. So if you want to call in at the end of Dr. Cook, you can call 813-239-9660. All of a sudden,
9663.
Oh, thank you. 813-239-9663. I know it like the back of my hand, but I couldn't get it out.
No problem.
And you can also send us an email at dj@wmnf.org.
Okay, well, I'm going to put this music on, and we will come back with Dr. John Cook. Down because I am really thrilled to say that we have our guest on the line. We have with us Dr. John Cook, PhD. He's an assistant research professor at George Mason University. He was initially trained as a physicist, and he recently completed his PhD in psychology at the University of Western Australia. And despite his newly minted PhD, John has been a towering figure in the field of climate communication for the past decade. In 2007, he created Skeptical Science, a website. It's devoted to explaining climate science and rebutting global warming misinformation. And his skepticalscience.com, I can truthfully say I have gone to that for so much information, and it is just an incredible resource. And I was impressed to realize, John, that it's been here since 2007. So welcome so much to the show.
Thanks, Mary, for having me. That must be the most enthusiastic introduction I've ever received.
Well, I really appreciate the work you are doing and so many others because, you know, I just in the show before, I just talked to the youth that are going to strike tomorrow. And I am totally 100% behind them, and I'm so thrilled that they get it. They don't have to be told that, well, is it really real? Is there this or that? You know, this kind of hesitation that, you know, I don't want to really be aware of how urgent the problem is. And so, yes, I am enthused because why did you form Skeptical Science, that fabulous website? And if people aren't familiar with it, I really suggest they go and check it out. Why did you decide to form that in 2007?
It actually began by getting into arguments with my father-in-law. We would have these family get-togethers, and he began throwing these arguments about climate change at me. He didn't think that climate change was real. And I started researching the issue and realized that a lot of his arguments were just not based on science. And like any son-in-law who doesn't want to get beaten in an argument with his father-in-law, I started researching the issue quite thoroughly and building up this database of all the possible arguments that my father-in-law might throw at me at the next get-together and what the science said about each one. And eventually I realized that other people might find that a useful resource as well. Other people have fathers or uncles or family members who don't accept climate science, and they might find it a useful resource as well.
Well, and at George Mason, you're with the Center for Climate Change Communication. And with your dual interests and degrees in physics and psychology, I think it's really important, because when we were communicating back and forth by email, I thought you made a really important point. Rather than my just giving points that I think are so important that we establish the misinformation and debunk it, so to speak, that you really, I thought, made such an important point that the reason that some people believe some of this misinformation to the point that they might dismiss facts is because they're having problems separating myths from facts. And when it comes to climate change and the data of science, this is really critical. And so could you go into some of that? Because I'm looking about having you on this show is really, I think, a teaching experience, particularly for the listeners, so they can really, really, I think, understand how to deal with the misinformation that's around there.
Yeah, I guess over the course of my PhD, I went into it trying to answer the question, what do we do about misinformation? And the first thing I found was an insight into why misinformation is dangerous. It's because when people are presented with facts and misinformation at the same time, they don't know how to resolve the conflict between the two. And so misinformation, fake news, it essentially can cancel out real news. But that also pointed to the answer, which is that we need to help people resolve the conflict between fake news and real news. And the way to do that is to explain the techniques that misinformation uses to distort the facts.
And what are some of the methods they use?
The way I summarize it, this makes it very easy for me to remember it, and I guess if I can remember it, then anyone can remember it, is there's five main techniques of science denial, and the I use an acronym FLICC, F-L-I-C-C, to remember these five techniques: fake experts, logical fallacies, impossible expectations, cherry-picking, and conspiracy theories. And I'm happy to go into more detail in those or give examples as we talk about it more.
Oh, well, and you know that I think that really, you know, let's face it, the reason we have so much problems with climate change is because there is so much money, there is so much profit in fossil fuels and the utilization of energy that we've had. And so, in a way, so much of this comes almost out of Big Tobacco's handbook, doesn't it? Discrediting the scientists, you know, putting doubt on the work, et cetera, and putting doubt on the medical implications. In other words, doubt, 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 doubt.
The tobacco example is the perfect analogy, because long before tobacco were spending money misinforming the public, their own internal scientists had done their own research and confirmed that smoking had health impacts, it caused cancer, and it was addictive. But rather than act on that research and do something for the public good, the tobacco industry instead spent millions misinforming and confusing the public. Exactly the same thing happened with the fossil fuel industry. As far back as the 1950s, their own internal scientists were conducting research and reported back to the tobacco, the fossil fuel executives, that burning fossil fuels caused climate change, and it would have damaging impacts on the environment and society going into the future. And after several decades of receiving this research from their own scientists, fossil fuel made the fateful decision to, rather than transition their business model to sustainable energy, they decided instead to spend millions and eventually adding up to billions of dollars confusing the public about climate science.
Yeah, and your website, and again, we're talking to John Cook, and I strongly suggest you go to the website, skepticalscience.com. Actually, you've got a video there by Shell that they did years ago pointing out the dangers, but of course, they didn't do anything about it. And I think that, and so we come to one of the main things, really, is that there's a saying that really, well, actually, not that many scientists, there's a lot of disagreement. You know, we really don't understand it. And so the fact that now it's almost 98% of scientists agree that somehow that this is passed as not the case.
Yeah, so there's been a number of studies done by scientists trying to quantify how much scientists agree that humans are causing global warming. And I published one of those studies in 2013. Now, when you look at all these different studies using lots of different methods, what they all conclude is that between 90 to 100% of climate scientists agree that humans are causing global warming, and multiple studies all converge on 97% consensus on human-caused global warming. So it's very clear from all the scientific research that the scientific consensus, climate scientists agree humans are causing global warming. And that's really important, because when you tell people, hey, the climate scientists agree, there's consensus, people become more accepting of the reality of climate change and more supportive of climate action. And so the people who oppose climate action do everything that they can to cast doubt on the scientific consensus. And as someone who's published one of the 97% consensus studies, I've experienced this myself. I've seen all the techniques used to cast doubt on our research and on the consensus. And the main technique is the technique of fake experts, using people who don't have any actual relevant expertise. They haven't published any climate research, but they may appear to be experts from the general public's point of view, and therefore they're quite effective in casting doubt on the science. A prominent example just over the last few weeks has been William Happer, who's a retired physicist. He hasn't published any research into climate change, but he's being used by the Trump administration at the moment to cast doubt on climate science. And because he's a physicist, a scientist from Princeton University, to the public, he seems like an expert. But he's actually a fake expert. He doesn't have any climate research.
Yeah, and I was hearing one supposed expert say that actually that he had been to both the Antarctic and the Arctic, and yes, you can see the ice mass disappearing, but we don't know why. As if, well, you know, if you don't know why, you can't do anything about it. And I found that was really quite interesting. That is not data.
No. Well, I mean, scientists have published many studies exploring why, and they all paint a consistent picture. We published a summary on Skeptical Science of all the studies that have tried to quantify how much humans have contributed to global warming, and they all cluster around 100%. Humans are basically causing all of the global warming that we've experienced over the last half century. So we do know why, and it's based on many different independent studies.
And, you know, that I really want to give a plug because right at the top of your website, for those, you know, for people who really don't understand the science and are, you know, they're not necessarily that scientifically inclined, you have for beginners, so to speak, or for people who don't understand, just an excellent summary of the kind of research, the kind of thinking. And it's really a very beautiful, I think, human story, if you will, how an individual really be questioned. You know, that, well, how come we're this warm? We're far enough from the sun that we really shouldn't be this warm. And that's what science is about, isn't it, John? Asking those kind of questions, which are really very basic, and then seeing what you come up with. And I think, and if they don't understand when people say, well, there really isn't that much carbon dioxide in the air, and it's a really good thing because plants need it, and we need plants. And, you know, just think how they all evolve, that they'll evolve with this too. And I think that I really highly recommend what a careful, well-presented history you gave.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to understand history, and it really gives you a perspective, because scientists have been asking those questions you just brought up since the early 1800s. Joseph Fourier asked the question, the Earth should be a lot cooler than it is. Like, based on how far away we are from the sun, the Earth should actually be about 0 degrees Fahrenheit on average, when it's actually about 60 degrees Fahrenheit on average. And so he wondered, well, what's causing that? And it wasn't till 1859, just a few years before the Civil War, that a scientist in England ran experiments and confirmed with an actual experiment that greenhouse gases trap heat, and that explains why the Earth is much warmer than it should be. And so the argument that CO2 is just a tiny part of the atmosphere and can't have a significant effect is wrong. It has a huge effect, like 60 degrees Fahrenheit difference. That seems pretty significant to me. We'd be living in an ice planet. If it would be like that ice planet in the Star Wars movie, where the whole planet was covered in ice, if it wasn't for greenhouse gases.
And if they would go through that history, they would see really that everything has consequences. And I think the really fascinating thing really about climate science right now is that how much effect will these, you know, gases we're putting in the air, in which we absolutely have to diminish and hope zero sum, but will they give a cloud cover? What kind of effect is that going to have? And then you have the problem of some people taking isolated facts and saying, see, it's actually now it's cooling. And again, you have to be very careful in what facts they're trying to use.
Yeah, one of the most common techniques of science denial is cherry picking. That was one of the C's in the flick, ICC. And cherry picking is basically just taking a small piece of the puzzle and ignoring the rest of the data. And you know someone is cherry picking when they give you an example or a small bit of data. But when you step back and look at all the data, you actually get the opposite conclusion. A good example of that is when someone says, well, look at what temperature has been doing just for the last, you know, 5 years or 2 years or 10 years. They might use just that small little segment of data to say global warming is not happening. But when you take a step back, you see that over the last 100 years, we've seen this steady, dramatic global warming, the temperature's been going up, and just looking at little segments of the temperature record is cherry-picking and ignoring the full picture.
And the final C in your thing are conspiracy theories. Now, I'm curious, are there some conspiracies you see going on?
Are there actual conspiracies, or yeah, are there conspiracy theories?
Well, either.
Well, I mean, firstly, I guess, when you have 97% consensus amongst climate scientists, when the whole world global community of climate scientists agree, if you're a climate denier who disagrees with that consensus, well, how do you explain that the whole world of scientists are disagreeing with you? Inevitably, you're going to resort to conspiracy theories and think that the scientists must all be plotting against you. But when you think about it, like, there's tens of thousands of climate scientists all over the world publishing research, going to meetings. The idea that a conspiracy could be maintained amongst this huge group, and I know scientists being one of them myself, but scientists are like, trying to organize them is like trying to herd cats. They're independent. they all go off in their own direction, and there's no way you could actually get all of them working together in such a secretive, coordinated manner. So on the one sense, it's completely implausible. And it really covers up the I guess you could say that the real conspiracy going on, which is a conspiracy to misinform the public. There's been misinformation campaigns happening, but not secretly, out in the open since the 1990s. We've had nearly three decades of misinformation casting doubt on climate science in order to confuse the public. And daylight is the best disinfectant, shining as much daylight on the misinformation campaigns and explaining to people how they're being misled is crucially important to neutralizing them.
And again, you're listening to WMNF, and we're talking to John Cook, and he is an extraordinary scientist, but very special, really, with communications, if you will. And he's with George Mason University, and I repeat, his skepticalscience.com website is absolutely invaluable. And, you know, I think one of the more interesting arguments I've been hearing is that actually it's politically correct to believe in climate change and to do something about that. Actually, if you're a climate denier or a skeptic about climate change, that somehow you're being oppressed and you're being discriminated against. Have you heard much of this politically correct argument before?
I've encountered the argument. I don't believe in political correctness. I believe in scientific correctness.
Well, what's wrong with you, John? I mean, the truth will set you free, right? And I was telling the young people that I was talking to in the earlier show that I think that you have, like, what, 10 words that you really put it on the line, and they really loved it, you know, about climate change. You know, it's real, it's bad, it's us, and science tells us we can do something about it.
Right.
And I think those are fighting words and so concise.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, while climate science is complicated and there's so much research, it's hard to keep up with it. On the other hand, it is a simple story. Like you said, it's real, it's us, it's bad. The experts agree on those first three points, but there's hope. We do have the solutions. We have all the technology we need to solve climate change. We just need the political will. And so ultimately, I think just telling those 10 words to people is a really important way that all of us can contribute to solving climate change. And often when people ask me how can they contribute, what can they do about it, I think that we can all do things in our personal lives to reduce our emissions, but the most important thing we can do is break climate silence. Not enough people are talking about the issue with their friends, their families, and their elected officials. And if more of us do that, it will build the social momentum and the political momentum, which is what we need in order to get meaningful climate action.
And I know I'm really excited, and many people are. I mean, the last data I saw is over 70% of the American people are really excited about the Green New Deal and, you know, all the possibilities that it offers. And I think that now, I think particularly being that, and you know, just here in Florida, the kind of environmental problems we have had just in the last few years, they're very serious and they're very real. They're ongoing, just with high tide, the flooding, et cetera. And so I think there's far more awareness than there was. And do you think that's part of the backlash why there is such an attempt to denigrate the scientists and also particularly affect science education in schools?
Yeah, it's been really encouraging, the survey data that we've been collecting at Mason in collaboration with Yale. Twice a year, we publish these huge surveys of the U.S. public. And we found that public awareness of climate change, public acceptance that it's happening and that we're causing it, and public support for action, including support for policies like the Green New Deal, are all going up and up and up across all these different climate measures. We're seeing public opinion going in the right direction, and that's really encouraging. And it's also important for people to realize that more than half of the public, the majority of Americans, accept that climate change is real and that humans are causing it, and only 10% or 9% of Americans are dismissive of the science. So while they may be a very vocal minority, they're also a very small minority, and we need to recognize that and be aware that most of the public are on board and want to do something about it.
Well, and Arlene, did you want to say something?
Well, I just wanted to ask John if he had a few minutes. If listeners have comments or questions, could you stay with us for just a few minutes?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Oh, that's great. And we do have, if you wish to make a comment or have a question for Dr. Cook, the number is 813-239-9663. We do have an email from a listener, David, and he says, climate change is caused by nature and people. If you want to reduce climate change, reduce population.
Well, what do you think about that, John?
So there's various contributors to climate change, and population is one factor, but the much greater factor is consumption. And so the parts of the world where population is going up the fastest are also the parts of the world that are contributing the least to climate change. So I don't think the population is the biggest factor, and I think consumption is a much more concerning factor, and it's also being the biggest factor, it's where we need to concentrate most of our energy on being more efficient and just transitioning to cleaner ways of living.
No, press the top one.
And caller, do you have a question for Dr. Cook? Caller, do you have a question for Dr. Cook? Caller, do you have a question for Dr. Cook?
Yeah. I wanted to ask about whether some folks might point out whether a CO2 tax would be part of the agenda that they're trying to, that we're skeptical of. I think it's also kind of strange to say that all global warming would be man-made. There are other greenhouse gases that the EPA lists, and I was just looking up on your website that you do mention fluorinated gases, which are the most impactful, and for some reason I see doesn't really get much play in the mainstream media, according to the EPA's website. Mentions CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, and fluorinated gases, which are the least plentiful but the most impactful because they are the most, they last the longest, and even though they comprise only 3% of greenhouse gas.
And listener, because we've got other callers, could you just give your question a little more concisely?
Well, yeah, fluorinated gases. Why isn't that's something that everyone can agree on, whether you believe in global warming, whether it's man-made or not, doesn't make any difference because fluorinated gases are the most toxic, as the EPA mentions. They're the only greenhouse gas that is man-made.
And so let's hear what Dr. Cook has to say. John, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, so when I talk about human activity causing all of global warming, usually human activity is a catch-all that includes all the other greenhouse gases that humans are emitting, including CFCs as well as CO2 and methane. But while methane and CFCs might be more powerful greenhouse gases, they're also being emitted at much lower quantities than burning of fossil fuels and CO2. And so when you look at the ultimate warming effect, CO2 is by far the most dominant greenhouse gas. So you're absolutely right that we shouldn't neglect other pollutants, particularly when they have other impacts on human health. But the most of the heavy lifting is done by CO2.
And thank you, caller.
And we also have a comment from one of our listeners who said that he prefers to see people use the words climate crisis as opposed to climate change. And he was pointing out that what we're really doing is working to save humans on the planet, that the planet will survive in some form, even if we don't.
I don't see anything to disagree with in any of those statements. I mean, it is a crisis, although I tend to use phrases like climate change, global warming, and climate crisis interchangeably. Like me personally, like I didn't come at this issue as an environmentalist. I came at it as someone with a physics background, a science background, and interested in truth, science, and facts. And it was only when I realized that climate change affects people, it affects society, it affects our infrastructure, our human health. That's when I realized that this is it's an issue that's not just about polar bears and penguins, it's about people. And that's when I really started to care about it and got a fire in the belly about climate change.
Okay, one more last question for John. Go ahead.
Hello? Yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking my my question. Dr. Cook, I was wondering, are you familiar with any of the things that Anchorage, Alaska has done, what the governor has done up there, specifically with the loading docks where she changed and got completely off of diesel fuel to run the giant lifts, the cranes?
No, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. Well, basically it was just, it's like an electric motor, like an alternator. And so those giant pods, once they get lifted up, the weight of the pod pulling on the cables as it lowers itself down spins this generator that generates its own electricity, and they're completely off of diesel fuel. And I was wondering if you feel like that would be a positive thing for possibly Tampa to do, or, you know, some of the larger ports to try to implement.
Yeah, I wish I knew more about it. I can only speak in general terms, but I guess the key thing I would say is that there are a whole range of ingenious technological solutions that engineers and scientists are coming up with to address all these problems that we have and all these jobs that need to get done in order to keep society running. And so I think what we need to be doing is doing less arguing about whether climate change is happening and more working together to come up with solutions like the ones that you're talking about. And that's really where this conversation needs to be centered on at the moment.
And thank you so much, caller. And again, I really want to thank you, Dr. Cook. And to me, really, you know, with the new Green Deal, as you just said, that the chances for people to be creative, I can only imagine what people will come up with. And they can be freed, so to speak, to use their imaginations. And to me, it can be a totally new, exciting world. So I really want to thank you for all you've done. I love your skepticalscience.com and all the work you've done, all the books and the articles you write. So keep up the great work, and thanks so much for giving us this time today. Any comments you wanted to make we didn't cover?
I thought it was a great show. I guess the main thing I want to do is thank you for talking about this issue. Getting conversations about climate change and how we can solve it is crucial, and shows like this really contribute to that.
Well, your work gives us the material. We can do it, and we'll have many more. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
And be sure to check out that website, skepticalscience.com.
Oh, it's loaded with information.
Both the boxes across the top, but scale down. They have news that they add every day. It's really important. And we also had an email from Louise from the Environmental Caucus of the Democratic Party of Florida. She says the caucus is collecting letters from people throughout the state saying how climate change has affected them or how looming fright of it affects their lives. It doesn't matter your party or political affiliation. They will present these letters to Representative Kathy Castor, who was asked by Speaker Pelosi to head a committee on climate change, and this is the way we are helping. We plan to submit the letters on Earth Day. The Environmental Caucus is collecting them to send all together. You can email to thepinecone@hotmail.com. Thank you.
And I'm very concerned, really, about the teaching of science in schools. I think it's so important. And as John was just talking about, that we have to be aware that there are some efforts to affect the teaching of science in schools. And so I was able to catch up with Dr. Brad Hoge yesterday. And so we probably will get most of this interview. But I think it's really important that we're aware also what's happening in Florida. Arlene, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to say a thank you to Suzanne House for her generous contribution today.
Oh.
She said that the show was at 10 o'clock was a great show. The interview with Sally was so interesting. Power to the kids. They're our salvation. So thank you, Suzanne. We really appreciate you and all the work you do.
It's all interconnected. That's what we have to realize. It's all interconnected, and every piece is just as important as every other piece. It's exciting. I really think it's really exciting. But I do want you to hear what Dr. Brad Hoge has to say. So let's give a listen to this. I am so happy to welcome to the show Brad Hoge. He is a PhD. He's the Director of Teacher Support at the National Center for Science Education in Oakland, California. So, Brad Hoge, welcome so much to the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you know that it's bad enough when we're in the urgency, particularly after the IPCC report, really having to really quickly do some things about climate change, to have the climate deniers, but at the same time, we have such a threat, really, and I know it's not really that new, but of teaching science in schools, and so I'm pretty concerned. Washington Post did a really wonderful article, and your organization was mentioned very prominently in the efforts to kind of affect what teachers can be teaching in classrooms in science in the schools now. Isn't that true?
Yes, it's true.
And, you know, that I know with evolution, you know, this has been going on for a long time, but climate change is kind of being put in the same category, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities between how the two are being attacked in standards and in certain legislation.
Well, and you know that I'm a real believer in science. I think it helps people in so many ways. And I think it's really important for children, particularly, to learn something about scientific methodology and to challenge, you know, that to have some ideas and to figure out how they can actually go about proving or disproving, and the value of investigation, that even if it turns out that what you thought isn't right, if you've done a really good job, that's very valuable information. And to me, that's just, I think it's a really good skill for children to get. And so I'm pretty upset, actually, that you have standards that you use. So explain a little bit what you mean about the standards they have for teaching science education, what they are.
Well, every state adopts their own standards, and many states have taken the national standards, NGSS, and either taken them directly or made some adjustments to them. But still, many other states have developed their own standards which can be quite different. The standards typically are recommendations for not only the content that should be taught, but the skills that need to be taught. And using NGSS as sort of the basis, it's really more of a skills-based approach. And the good part of that, and as you were talking about what students should learn about science, I think it you were right on the money, because science is all about data and evidence and how that data is eventually leads to conclusions and consensus. But it's a very long process where scientists continually do experiments over and over again, test themselves, test their ideas, test their assumptions, and so on. And eventually that the data proves out. And if students can participate in that, and climate change gives them a really good opportunity to do that, then they can experience that process for themselves. They can gain the skills of being able to analyze data in a way that leads to conclusions that can be trusted, rather than simply being told something by the teacher.
And, you know, I know with some of the arguments over evolution, which have been going on for a long time, that there were just all kinds of end-rounds, if you will, to prevent, the teaching of evolution, or to somewhat affect it. And, to present creationism as an alternate theory, so to speak, and kind of this really kind of hard, the difference between a scientific fact and data and a theory, is kind of obscured. And but with climate change, I think it's really kind of interesting, because so much of that actually is founded in a questioning, of the veracity of the data and agreements to the scientists to the data. And I was somewhat troubled to see a familiar organization, actually, the Heartland Institute. Mm-hmm. And so tell us about this pamphlet that was sent out to so many of the science teachers that, voila, and they're making cereal box, they get this, pamphlet plus a DVD going on all the myths of climate change as a science.
Yeah, the Heartland Institute is one of the major groups that are trying to undermine the teaching of climate change in particular, and they're using an old playbook that was really established by the tobacco wars and even earlier than that. And so they basically put out a booklet for teachers, and it was titled Why Scientists Disagree About Climate Change. And it was pretty deliberate in its attempt to use misinformation to get teachers to teach climate change as unsettled or debatable. And I think in this approach and the one, as you were talking about evolution, there really is a persistent misunderstanding of exactly how science is done. And as you said, what the differences are between factual observations and data in science versus theory, and how theory works to make predictions that scientists can then test and explore. And in both situations, the theory is what's misunderstood. That most people who generally attack these two areas, again, just persistently misunderstand exactly how a theory works in science.
But we're talking to Brad Hogue, and he is the director of teacher support for the National Center for Science Education, and we're talking about climate change in particular the way that there's trying to be the effect on schools. And I think it's pretty problematic when they're saying, and I know right here in Florida, and a pretty familiar legislator in the Florida legislature, Baxley, who has introduced several bills about creationism throughout the years, but now he's into climate change, and we have three bills right now in the Florida legislature, which are trying to affect I think most of them are essentially saying that there has to be balance in the teaching, as if there right. is a balance between evolution as theory and evolution as the scientific evolution of it, and also climate change, as if that somehow the theories of climate change, the deniers primarily, are on equal basis with the science. And to me, this is pretty, I don't know if they realize how much they're putting their thumb on the scales.
Well, appealing to a false equivalency is one of the logical fallacies that many people who try to deny climate change attempt to assert. And so there's 97% consensus among climate scientists that humans are causing climate change, and they'll try to make that if you're going to make that argument, you have to balance it with the other side. Well, the other side is a very small number of scientists, and really a smaller number all the time. It's even closer to 98% now. And so it's not an equal position. And again, science isn't debated. Science doesn't work that way. It's not like you stake out two positions, and then find a compromise or reach some kind of agreement in the middle. Science is entirely about the evidence. And so when we say there's a 97% consensus among climate scientists, it's because they've examined the evidence for decades, and in many different ways, and from many different lines of evidence. And all of these lines of evidence lead to the same conclusions when the scientific analysis is done. And that's why there's a consensus. So to introduce, and that, again, the common tactic is to try to appeal to people's normal sense of fairness in terms of balancing arguments. And in a policy debate or in most debate style situations, that would make sense for there to be a balanced approach and to teach both sides and to introduce where there's controversy. But in these situations, that's simply not appropriate because it's not how science works, and it obscures the fact of just how solid the evidence is for both evolution and climate change.
Yeah, and they try and say, this data just collected since 1900, and that really we don't understand, it's either nature or God, and the climate's been warming up ever since the ice age, when in fact they totally disregard ice cores, which go back thousands of years, and ocean sediment and tree rings. In other words, these go back thousands of years. computers and that kind of data. But there is this effort at equivalency. And also, you know, they try, and also I thought it was really kind of interesting that they're trying to say, well, whoa, you know, that that you can't do any harm, and that fossil fuels and, you know, you say that human beings are the main ones that have contributed to carbon dioxide. Well, carbon dioxide is a good thing. Plants need it. We need plants, et cetera. And it all seems logical if you don't understand anything about science. And this is why I think it's so important for teachers to be able to, you know, carefully be able to teach the children so they can use their own minds and their own approach to data. And yet already this year, I think that there are more states that have tried to introduce, you know, impediments to the teachers than you had practically all last year already.
Yeah, in fact, it may seem logical, but most of the arguments actually appeal to logical fallacy. And so cherry picking and the sort, some of the things that you described, really are, again, logical fallacy rather than logic. If you look at the historical record of climate change over the last hundreds of thousands of years from ice core records, you can calculate the slope of change for any of the cycles that we've gone through. And we've gone through numerous glacial cycles. We're currently are in an interglacial period. But the signal of the natural signal has already worked its way out. We would be entering the point of the curve on that cycle where we would actually be going back towards, or where it's no longer warming. It's actually evening out. But you can do the slope of the current rate of change of CO2 and temperature, and it's an order of magnitude greater than any other time in the last few hundred thousand years. So there's obviously a human signal there. Again, when they talk about, well, climate has always changed in the past, and this is just natural, they're appealing to logical fallacy rather than to real logic.
Yeah, and again, we're talking to Brad Hogue, and as you can see, he's eminently qualified to be the director of teacher support for the National Center for Science Education. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, about the ozone layer and the work by Dr. Solomon and others, to really realize that there was a hole in the ozone. This was very serious. And and that actually, you know, by eliminating certain, you know, gases, et cetera, that actually that hole is repairing itself. And to me, that is almost a perfect example of human contribution to changes, you know, in our climate, and luckily doing something about it in time to, affect a positive change. And right. I wonder what a lot of these deniers think of that.
Well, that's an interesting point. I would put acid rain in there as well. I was reviewing some textbooks from the 90s that are trying to update their text, and the bigger issues back in the 80s were the ozone hole and acid rain. And you're right, we have addressed both of those issues and made major improvements by changing what we put into the atmosphere. So there's no doubt that humans can have an impact on the atmosphere, and that we can also find solutions. And I think right now in climate change, it's an interesting phenomena going on, because there really is a lot of energy on both sides. It's almost where the deniers are ratcheting up their attempt to deny things, because there's a lot of energy on the side of climate education and putting climate into the standards from the other side, from the public. And the Yale Center for Climate Communication does a study over and over again. It's called the Six Americas, where they ask people if they're alarmed or if they're concerned or if they're neutral or if they're ambivalent or they're deniers. And there's actually been a pretty significant shift towards people who are concerned about climate change in the general public. And I think that this sort of wave of support for climate change is actually alarming the deniers a little bit, and they're trying best they can to get some legislation in place that would slow it down or actually stop it.
Yeah, and so they're aiming at the teachers. And I was pretty upset with they were trying to say, well, you know, that if they're that they can't make any political points, et cetera, their own personal. They have to take an ethics standard, and that they can't give their own personal opinions. And it comes to find out that in many political parties in many, many states, that actually evolution and climate change are specifically mentioned. And even though one would not think that this would be involved, that this actually could, they're trying to make that to preclude a teacher being able to teach this. And to me, these are kind of end runs that are pretty specious, and I think can be very damaging.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is one of the newer strategies, is to try to appeal to this as an ethical issue in terms of teacher ethics, what a teacher's ethics should be. And that is not to indoctrinate their students or not to give students one side of an issue. And it's just another iteration of that strategy that's been attempted for a long time, of trying to make this teach both sides of the issue and teach the controversy, which have failed for the most part. And so now they're trying to appeal to, again, what would make sense in out of context, that a teacher should have a certain ethics and not indoctrinate their students. Obviously, people would agree with that. The point that's being obscured, of course, is that teachers are not indoctrinating their students when they're teaching climate change correctly. And so when teachers are teaching climate change correctly, that is the ethical thing for teachers to do. That does not involve a false equivalency of then balancing their teaching of climate change with the denier's position. Matter of fact, that would be the opposite. But the legislators who are trying to push this as an angle are trying to use language that would make most people support the position, unless they really drilled down into it and saw where it fell apart.
Yeah, and so many people, you know, misunderstand specific weather events. And, you know, you'll have a president saying, oh, well, we could use some of that warming now. Or I was pretty horrified yesterday at his tweet that, you know, fake science, climate change is fake news, fake science. And he was, implicating this person, Moore, who is a co-founder of the Greenpeace, who was not. And so you really realize how up against it, because I'm kind of, you know, I've been following this, and particularly with the IPCC recent report, I'm very convinced of the urgency of this time. And so, and I think one of the things that's great is that tomorrow actually is the children's strike, and the kids, you're obviously doing a good job teaching the kids, and they're learning a lot because they recognize the seriousness of it. And, you know, they're particularly talking about their lives and their future because they are getting it. And so I think it's so important right now to have everybody realize, and to really get in there and to realize that we are really challenged here for our survival, and that it's important that we really learn from some of our experts and our scientific data. You know, they're not out there to make a political point. And tell me, what do you think about the children's strike tomorrow, Friday, March 15th?
Yeah, I agree with you that I think this generation is taking this issue on as very personally. I mean, because they do see their futures involved and at stake in a unique way. It's there's a danger of accepting what you're growing up with as the normal, whatever it is. And I think we've all kind of experienced that. As you get a little bit older as I am, you can look back at your childhood and see trends in the weather that are simply not happening today. And you can see that there's something different. But today still feels, you know, seasonally somewhat normal. So it's really encouraging to me that this generation is recognizing the fact that this isn't normal, and that their futures are going to be drastically different. And so I applaud them for the energy that they're putting into this and putting into all of these efforts to get people to pay attention. And I think what's positive about the strike is just that, that they're trying to get people to pay attention to the issue, particularly their government and their leaders. They're not out there trying to make arguments themselves. They're simply saying, pay attention to this. This is a big issue. This is a real important issue to us, and you need to be paying attention.
Well, Brad Hoag, Director of Teacher Support, National Center for Science Education, I really want to thank you for all the time you've given us this morning. I know this is pretty early out there in Oakland, California, and we've covered a lot of areas. Is there any area particularly that we didn't mention that you want to mention?
Nothing comes to mind. I think that a couple of topics may have come up in the course of our conversation that I wasn't able to address. So I'll leave it to you if you feel like there's anything that maybe that you mentioned or that you'd like me to go back to.
No, I think you've done a very good job.
And I think we have pretty much run out of time. Thanks so much for listening. I hope we've given you more information about climate change and some resources that you can check it out. You want to make your own opinions. And don't forget John Cook's words, that climate change, it's real, it's bad, it's us. Science says we can do something about it. There's hope. Oh,
show, Kate. Arlene?
And your last guest was Dr. Hoag?
Brad Hoag, yes. Okay, I'm going to put this music on and then the news, and stay tuned. There's going to be a great show coming up about artists in the community.